Hi, and welcome to another episode of the Start Writing Podcast. This is the next episode in A Beginner's Guide to Writing a Novel. And the last couple episodes have been about character. I call them hero and then heroes. This is actually more about character. We're going to touch on villains, so I'm calling it that. But this is mostly just more about how to build deep characters. That's what I want to cover today. Okay. So I think I've mentioned that I have what is called the braid in Star Child, and it has vision, initiative, and spirit. And when I think, I've gotten so deep into my own magic system, which I know is super nerdy, that that's the framework I think in. And so I've presented this to the podcast, and I feel like it was just confusing. It wasn't helpful. So, and just like 20 minutes ago, as I was prepping for this episode, I'm like, oh my gosh, I think I'm just being confusing. That's the opposite of my objective. So, so I drew out this little sketch right here. And if you're listening, you can't see the video. It's just roughly a human form. And the head is past. And then the heart is personality. And the feet is proactivity. And basically, I mean, that's vision, spirit, and initiative. But like, what's in your head? So you need to have these three things to make a deep and a fleshed out character. And so you need to look into their past, and you need to figure out what they believe and why, and what their scars are and what their skills are. Like, what are they bringing to the table from the past? And I'm representing that by the head. And then their personality, that's the heart. And, you know, that's, we talked about pet the dog. Like, do they do things that are relatable and are they likable? Yeah. And then save the cat, which is, do they do something good? So that's the heart. That's personality. And then proactivity is the feet. They need to be pursuing an objective, and they need to be doing this courageously. And that implies that they have obstacles. So there has to be things in their way of getting what they want. And I think if you can cover those three things, you're going to have a pretty fleshed out character. That, to me, that's the fundamentals right there. And my apologies if what I presented last time kind of befuddled that or like made it confusing. Sorry, do you have a comment?
No, actually, I was going to say, before this, did you listen to it and were like, that didn't come out clear?
To be honest, I didn't re-listen today. It was just me looking at the slides, and I just thought, you know what? I don't think it's getting across with the labels. Like, to me, vision, spirit, and initiative makes perfect sense. But they're foreign terms for most people. And I just think past personality and proactivity is a simpler way to get the same concept across.
Or I would say backstory, character, and goals is how I would frame it.
Yep. Yeah. So whatever works for you, and hopefully this helps. But okay, so I lived on the Navajo reservation for a little while, and so
I didn't know that.
Yeah. So I love anything that has to do with, you know, Native Americans, but particularly Navajos. There's this book that I've been meaning to read for years called Skinwalkers, and I finally got around to reading it and loved it. And part of the reason I loved it was because it brought me back to that place.
Right.
But he has this cool little like author intro at the beginning where he just talks about his craft. And there were a couple really cool takeaways that I just wanted to share with listeners. And one of them is really pertinent to our discussion today. He said so the author's name is Tony Hillerman, and he's going to book signings. And so, you know, book signings, that means his fans, these are the people that love him, right? And they're coming to get his signature. And there's this lady, you know, hands him the book and will you sign it? And she says, why did you change Leaphorn's name to Chi? And so you probably haven't read Hillerman. He has these two detectives, and one is kind of an older Navajo police detective named Leaphorn, and one's this younger guy named Jim Chi. And he'd written some novels about Leaphorn, and then he started writing novels about Chi. And he literally had a reader, a fan, who picked up the Chi books and thought, oh, this is the same character, but for some reason he has a different name. And so then Hillerman says, it took a split second for the significance to sink in. A dagger to the heart. I stutter, search around for an answer, and finally just say, They're totally different characters. So he tells her the truth.
Right.
And then she says, oh, I can't tell them apart. And so he then came up with this idea and challenge. He says, I'm going to put these two characters in the same novel so that I become really clear on what distinguishes these two characters from one another. And that book is Skinwalkers. And he went on to write several more novels where these two favorite detectives are in the same novel. And they're like really cool novels. They did really well. But I just think it's so cool that he hadn't made the characters distinct enough. And then, I mean, when I read Skinwalkers, it was like crystal clear. It was very easy to tell these two cops apart. And it was fun to kind of see them interacting too, by the way. But anyway, that was one really cool tidbit that I just love that he shared that insight. And I mean, honestly, kind of embarrassing. It was brave of him, I think. And I thought it was super cool that he would share that story.
Yeah, that is. That's crazy. Did you find anywhere where he like outlined the changes that he made or what he did, or just he's like, I had them side by side, so it was easy for me to see the similarities and then make changes?
So he doesn't, the intro thing that I read, it was very brief, and I found myself wanting more. I wish he'd described more, but no, unfortunately he doesn't. But so another interesting story, and this one's more of a side note. That one fit our topic today. This is a side note, but I still wanted to share it. He says he had a reader point out to him years later after he'd published a novel. He said, how come so-and-so never got his shoes back? And it turns out that some, and this is a book I haven't read, but some guy, maybe it's Liebhorn, he gets imprisoned, captured or something. They take his shoes and he climbs out of a window. He escapes. And then the rest of the novel happens, and in the novel, he never gets shoes back. But this was just never acknowledged or addressed or anything. And in fact, no one, including the author, had even noticed it until this fan writes in and said, how come he never got his shoes back? And that made me think about this. So on the screen, I have this framework of when you're traditionally published, you write a first draft, a second draft, third draft, however many, and then you send it to your publisher. And after that, I have a graph here where it's improving, it's going up. And when you send it to your publisher, the line is then flat after that, it plateaus. If the book sells a ton, you'll get to make a second edition, and that means you'll get to write a new introduction, but you're still not going to put the shoes back on. And that made me think about the value of being an indie author. So Tony Hillerman was frustrated that he had this mistake where, he needs to write two sentences like how he gets the shoes back, but he can't.
And he couldn't.
His hands are tied. And that just made me think, well, that's one of the strengths of being an indie author. Like, I'm in control of my IP, and at any time I can go back and I can put the shoes back on. And now there is an exception to that, which is the audiobook. It's very difficult to edit an audiobook. So if you're that phase, maybe not. But I value that ability, and I want to be able to keep refining my books. And again, there's a trade-off. You can get stuck on the same novel for the rest of your life if you do this forever. So there's got to be a point where you leave things alone. But Sorry, go on.
For me, I mean, I definitely see this, but like right at this point in my writing career, I am so focused on just trying to write these stories at all that I'm not really thinking about going back and fixing and adjusting, you know, anything. It's just like, I've just got to move forward.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, and that's something I've noticed too with Star Child, where I'm getting to a point, I'm about to finish this trilogy, but in theory, I'm going to write two more trilogies, and it's a lot of work. And part of me is wanting kind of a refresh, almost like to go back to one of my other series or start a new one, just kind of to change things up a bit. So yeah, it's challenging, and you definitely don't want to get stuck on the same novel forever. But anyway.
But I do think like this is a simple fix. And one thing you did mention, like it gets harder with audio, but if you read your own audiobook, then it's not. Then you just go
that's through, true.
Like, I that's changed true. This chapter. In fact, you don't even have to reread the whole chapter, right? Yeah. You can just be like, read your two lines and look where you looked, inserted them in the manuscript, and then insert that into the audio, and you're good to go.
Man, right? I have to say, I've listened to a few audiobooks where I've heard them insert a different phrase and the narrator's tone of voice has changed just
Yeah,
slightly. And
it's
I think
true.
it changes
It's
every
true.
day, like throughout the day, the more you talk. And
Or,
anyway, I've noticed that where they've
yeah,
inserted
one
a
thing I always
phrase.
notice is the narrator will be reading, and it's like either they took a break or they just took a drink of water, and like their voice like resets, you know? It's like, and
Yeah.
you can hear it. So, and I like almost every time I can hear it at the end of a chapter and the start of the next one because
Yeah.
it's like
Yep.
they took a break between, and you can hear their voice. It shifts because they're fresh.
Yeah, that's so funny. Man, so here's another side note. If I narrate one of my own books, it'll probably be the X Dot series. For Starchild, I've already found some narrators I like, but I've been wondering whether I should do different narrators for each perspective. And I know that can be really fun. I have like six or seven different perspectives. Anyway, I don't know if it's worth the hassle, but I think it would be really cool if I did do it. Anyway. Okay, so this was a question that was sent in a comment made on our last episode. And Richard says something you touched on but didn't really expand on. Character quirks. How important is it to give your characters quirks? How about giving your character a hobby that doesn't touch the plot in any way? Like maybe they're interested in stamp collecting. Would this be interesting backstory or something that should be cut as dead weight? Anyway, I love this question. It's so on topic, and it reveals something that I just haven't made clear, and I think is a really, really important principle. And I'm gonna answer it with two pieces of literature that I've encountered. Well, one's a movie. I recently read Miss Peregrine's Home for Peculiar Children. In that book, the hero is a kid. And his father is a bird watcher. And to me, this is the stamp collector thing, right? It's like a quirky, interesting thing. But there is a point. Well, I should back up. So yes, the character has the quirk. He has the stamp collecting hobby, and it's bird watching. But it does more than simply be a plain quirk. And what happens is, first, it illustrates the relationship between the kid and his father. So, to the kid, he thinks it's a strange hobby. He doesn't get it and he doesn't like it. And so, because the father has a strange hobby, you kind of see this rift between them. So, it's showing us the character. He's peculiar or different, but then he doesn't get along with his son. And so, it's doing more than just that first thing. And then it actually affects the plot later. A significant bird comes and lands on the windowsill, and the boy, the hero, just sees a bird, and his dad says, "That's a peregrine falcon." And I mean, the title of the book, Peregrine, it matters in the plot, and I won't spoil what's going on, but that quirky hobby matters in the plot. And that's kind of the point that I hope to get across about the braid, where you should never have something in your story that's only serving the world or only serving a character or only serving the plot. It needs to do all of these. And the more you can weave those together into this tight bundle, the stronger your story is going to be.
So I would almost look at this as a draft anomaly, right? In the first draft, your character just has a quirk. In the second draft, everything is written, you know where everything is going, and now you can be like, okay, this quirk is there. How can I graft that into a point later in the book? Right? And so it's in the beginning you were just shaping a character, but now that you have a full draft and you're going through and improving things, that's a simple adjustment to improve that trait and then now graft it into the plot. Now it's there. Now we did talk about this before, but it bears mentioning here. Giving a character just a quirk for the purpose of giving them a quirk. This is what we see with Dan Brown, right? The Mickey Mouse watch. It never has a plot function, right? It is entirely there just to give more flavor to that character.
And it's not that it does nothing, it's just that it doesn't do as much as it could, and that's kind of a shame.
Yeah, and that's kind of a shame, but I mean, I guess, but I don't see Dan Brown as a strong character writer, you know, like Doctor. I mean, I have read multiples of Dan Brown's books, and what can I tell you about Dr. Langdon? Not much,
Just the
you
watch.
know.
That's all we
He
got.
used to swim in college. He has that watch. He likes to solve puzzles. You know, that's what I know about this guy. And I've read like four books about him, you know.
No, that's completely on point. Exactly.
You know, where is that? You know, what do I know about Harry Potter? Be like, I don't even know where to begin. It's a big list, you know? So yeah, I think part of it is these traits, when they're just these independent quirks, they're harder to hold on to without that graft into the plot. And so as much as they're helping to define the characters, they fade very quickly because that is all they do, right? In the same way that this is when they were making the Hunger Games into a movie, and they chose a little black girl to play Rue, and a lot of people on the internet were upset about this. And then somebody pointed out, be like, "Have you read the book? She's black in the book." You know, and people were like, "Wait, what? She is?" You know, and what had happened was her skin color was not relevant to the plot. It for a lot of people, it just faded, and they rewrote her the way they wanted to, you know, in whatever way. You know, and so, but that's just pointing out that anytime you a character has a trait that isn't entangled in the plot, a lot of times readers will just override it with, you know, whatever flavor they feel from the character.
Man, that's a really cool example from The Hunger Games. That's exactly right.
So I mean, I think, you know, like you said, you could give your characters quirk to define them, but a lot of times these will fade and just be overwritten by your readers, and not strengthen the character the way you want them without them becoming part of the plot. But once they're part of the plot, to understand the plot, they have to remember the trait that it is part of your character.
And it's like impossible to miss if in that case.
It like you said, it becomes braided, and you can't pull one out with it. You know, they can't change that trait about your character without pulling the whole plot apart, and their brain's not going to do that, you know.
This is so funny. So I have a picture of Nick Cage on the screen from National Treasure, and he and I are wearing like the same color shirt. That's so funny.
That's
So,
great.
and this is another example I wanted to bring up, and I'll try not to beat a dead horse, but the Abigail character has a collection of presidential inaugural pins, and they're up on a shelf, and one of them is missing. And so there's a story, there's some elements to that right there, that a missing pin, right? So that's a cool hobby going on. But then they integrate it into the plot in that he gives her the missing pin. So it's like building that romantic. There's a theme of romance in the movie, but then it also they put some chemical on the coin so that they can then track her fingerprints, and it helps them steal the Declaration later. So it's part of her personality. She's into history, but they integrate it into the rest. Richard, I hope that answers your question well. And thank you so much for chiming in. So here's so the point of what we're talking about today is depth. How do we get character depth? And so I just want to bring up this example from my own writing. Starchild Book Two, a significant part of the premise is that the main character wants to train to become a better warrior, and so that he can become a better protector. And even in the early drafts, that was in there, and he says that, and he follows through on that, and that was in there. But what I hadn't done was show it. And later on, with the discussion with a reader, I got the idea to now Act One, Scene One, he gets beaten up and fails as a protector, and so then all the stuff that I'd already written mattered more because I'd showed it instead of just saying this is what he wants. I showed this is why he wants that. And that's something you want to do to add that depth to your character's personality and their objectives and all that. Another thing I want to talk about, and hopefully this isn't just old hat, but Superman, the most interesting thing about Superman is not that he can jump over buildings or fly or shoot lasers from his eyes. It's that he has a weakness and that kryptonite. There's a way that he can be destroyed in spite of being so powerful. And that, I think, is another really important part of building a deep character. You need to have a shortcoming or a flaw or some kind of inability to be heroic. And that's going to round them out. That's going to make them dynamic. And so, I mean, this isn't part of the homework screen, but that should be part of your homework, is to think about, here's my hero. What is his flaw? What is his limitation? And make sure that that's in there for your most important characters.
So, in the podcast, The Floor, we were talking about the history of comic books, and in the very first early comic books, everything was very black and white, right? Good was good, bad was bad, and it was just very cut and dried and simple. And because they were the very first comic books being made, they had this initial boom because people were like, oh, this is really cool. We've got the images with the story. It's great. And then th their sales started to stumble and fall. And so what they started doing was to make things a little murkier, good to your villains and weakness and shortcomings and even bad traits in your heroes. And this is where we get, heroes like Batman, who, is very complicated. And that really revives the entire comic book industry because suddenly there was a lot more people being interested in the stories. One of the things we identify in psychology is that children like very black and white stories, good and evil and all of that. But adults and even teenagers, they like things a little more complicated because if things are too black and white, it doesn't feel real enough. That If the world is too black and white, that alone can break the spell of the story because like, nothing is that black and white,
Man, that's cool. I haven't listened to that episode, but I love your Floor podcast. It's so
Oh,
good.
good. So, but yeah, we did. And I don't even remember if that actually is in like a full episode or maybe that gets brought up in the treasure room. But in one of our comic book discussions, we go into that how that really revived the comic book industry. And that's where we get these more complicated heroes like Wolverine.
And that's so interesting too, because it sounds like they were writing for a child's psychology, a child mindset. And maybe those kids had grown up and
Yeah.
that it was the same market, but they were older now and they needed that more mature story.
Yeah.
But,
Yeah. Well, and we do talk about that as well, that it's, part of that was is that their initial audience was older now and the black and white stories just didn't cut it anymore,
Yeah.
So.
Man, that rings so true to me where, yeah, I want stories that are grown up. And
Yeah.
anyway. Okay, so one thing I wanted to mention. So we're going to talk about there's a lot of things that you can do to build characters, and you'll hear people casting dispersion on, oh, that character's so flat and so they suck and da da da. I think that, so on the screen here, I've got kind of a hierarchy and, number one hero at the top or number one character and then on down to number 10. So let's say you have 10 characters in your book. You need to have some sort of a hierarchy about at the top is my hero, and this is going to be a very dynamic character. And it's okay to have people at the bottom of that hierarchy, sorry, characters who are kind of flat. It's totally fine. But I think if you're going to have a good character story, you need to have someone at the top of that hierarchy, a few people maybe, and they need to be deep and well-rounded characters. And I think this also helps with the workload, right? It's helpful to not have to do that with every character.
I know I've seen there's a couple of movies I've seen where people like complained that the characters were stereotyped and flat and everything, and I was like, I don't even remember noticing that in it. And so I think like people who are always like very character focused will always find fault that not every single character is deep and complex. Like they can't all be. They're too many.
Yeah. And I mean, there are people that want that, and you don't have to write to those people. You can. I think it's great if you do, but I don't think it's necessary. So I'm kind of talking about the minimum requirements here, I think. And I think you need to have a hero who is, and then you kind of go from there.
Yeah.
In one of the earlier episodes, I think I already mentioned this reader diagnostic question, but I've just started asking it, and I ask my beta readers to pick their top five characters in order of preference. And I haven't done it a lot yet, but no one has picked the same five or in the same order. And that is surprising to me, but also a really good illustration. So I'm suggesting this, that you listeners might do that too. Ask them to rate their favorite characters, and that can include the bad guys. My bad guys keep showing up on this top five list, even though I've got like, you know, seven or eight main characters in these books. Incidentally, a character that I wish were up at the top doesn't reach the top. And that's also another really important insight that I think I've gotten from that question.
Wait, go deeper into that.
Well, I mean, so basically what I'm saying is I have my top five characters, and my readers are not doing what I do. And that's fine. I think it's important to get their insights and perspective, but it also makes me wonder if I misstepped somewhere and they're not liking this character. Like, what did I do wrong? Like, what was offensive or unlikable? Because that's what you want in a hero, right? You want your hero to be likable. And granted, this is a kind of a secondary hero, but I'm still trying to make this person likable, and it hasn't been going as well as I've wanted. And it's a cool insight to get that feedback and then try to figure out why, what's going on here that I did wrong.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, part of it is it not that like, what is it? I know that in one of my books, you know, a character that a lot of people like because she is very, very complicated is Alice. But I've had a few people mention that they really don't like her. And I was asking, you know, one of them why. And he says, well, I know a girl who's like that and I don't like her, you know. And so, you know, that's always going to happen in the creation of characters. Some of our characters will remind readers of people they don't like, and they won't like them for that reason. You know.
Yeah. Well, and to be honest, this story functions really well if you don't like this character. But I think it also functions really well if you do like this character. And it's a little frustrating to me that it keeps coming across the wrong way. Mm. Honestly, it's no big deal. It really isn't, because I think the character's authentic to himself. But anyway, it's been an interesting study to figure out why is this coming across different than how I perceive it as an author.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so the homework, the last slide is going to describe this character sketch Bible. So a couple episodes ago, we talked about the story Bible, and in there, I put all my notes about the world and about the plot and some about the characters. But I go so deep into characters that I actually have a separate document that I keep character sketches in. And so if you look in the show notes, just go to your podcast or YouTube down below. There's a link to the Google Doc I use, and it's cobbled together from a few sources which are cited in the doc. But it's just a bunch of questions that you can ask about your character. And the first one that we talked about last time, the first segment, is really short. It's like 10 questions. You should probably fill out those 10 questions for every single character in your book. And by the way, I don't count it as a character if they have like one speaking line or one minor scene. That's like an extra. That's not a character.
Oh, that's a good point. Yeah, that's an extra.
So like your 10 main characters or whoever, you ought to do the 10 questions for. Now, there's a medium length list. So it's like 2 pages long. And I think you should do that for any character that you want to have like depth to. And then I've got a longer one. It's literally 20 pages of questions. And if you answer all those questions, it becomes 40 pages. And I've done that on a few characters. And so my character Bibles are massive, and that's why I actually moved it to a separate document. But so this is your homework, and it's to explore your characters' personalities deeper through this document. And I wanted to take you through a couple examples. So the list on the screen lists emotional shortcoming, mundane concern, or material possession. So it's like, okay, what is my character's emotional shortcoming? And I came up with 2 examples of that. In the King's Speech, the King of England is incapable of getting on the radio. Man, I'm going to develop a stutter just thinking about this. He's podcasting to all of England back during World War II. And he's frightened and has a stutter, a mental block because of it. So it's like an emotional shortcoming. And similarly with Avatar Aang in The Last Airbender, he's the Avatar. He's like basically God or Jesus. He's come to save the world and he can't go into the spirit world. It's like at a certain point in the series. But these are like mental shortcomings that lead to like there are physical things they can't do because of it. And I mean, the King's Speech is all about that internal struggle. I can't stand in front of England and speak. I stutter. And that, to me, that's the sort of answer that you could say for an emotional shortcoming. And there are many other ways that you could answer that too, by the way. Another example. So what is a mundane concern that your character has? And I came up with Glockta, who's this, he's from the blade itself and he has really brittle bones. In fact, there's Mr. Glass from Unbreakable is similar. But because his bones are so brittle, he's such a fragile body physically that he obsesses over staircases. And to me, like I never think twice about staircases, but going with that character down a staircase and cringing and hating that process, that to me, the reader is so mundane. That was a really cool character moment for me, a very memorable one. And then the last, a material possession. Is there a material possession that your character could or does have that matters, that makes them deeper? And in the new Magnificent Seven movie, Chris Pratt is this, you know, he's actually kind of a drunkard illustrated by this object, but he, in Act One, he keeps asking for whiskey and he's obsessed with finding whiskey. So you kind of get the idea that he's a drunkard. And then he, once he gets it, he carries it with him. So you just keep seeing him pull out this whiskey over and over and you're like, oh, like that's an important possession to him. And then because that's been set up in Act One and Act Two, in Act Three, he gives his whiskey to a dying man. And you know how much that means to him. And that moment, just like, at least for me, it just like totally gets me that, wow, that was such an act of compassion and generosity. And yeah. It only is because it was set up as a material possession that character really cares about.
Again, that almost feels like an edit addition, right? I think
totally.
You have him give the man whiskey when he's dying, but it'd be like, what if that's not just him giving whiskey? What if that's a sacrifice?
Yeah.
And so you go back and you build in the other two pieces.
And man, and I'm so glad you brought this up because it's not that hard to do. If you write that in the last scene,
it's not that hard to do.
You're going to have to write, you know, three sentences in four chapters, let's say. Three sentences a piece in four chapters. It's not a ton of writing, but you just got to set that up.
But then it's a great moment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And then it's braided in. It's tight with the rest.
Yeah.
Okay. So your homework is this document that's 20 pages and that's just for one character. And so I wanted to give you this word of warning. On the screen here, I have Guybrush Threepwood from Curse of Monkey Island. This is a game I loved as a kid. And he's saying, hang on. The quicksand is sucking all the cool stuff I found in that snake from my pants. And this is just meant to illustrate that you can get lost in character and character Bibles forever. It can suck all the cool stuff out of your pants.
that's funny.
and so, again, I think I mentioned this last episode. If you're into Dungeons and Dragons and you're a dungeon master and your purpose is to build worlds, then go ahead, get lost in character forever. That's awesome. It's fun. But if your objective is to publish a novel and to make that a success and reach readers, you can't get stuck in this character stuff forever. So this is just my word of warning. You as an artist have to make a trade-off between too little character or too much character. And I think people tend to err on the side of too little, but look at your writing and figure out where you need to land on that spectrum. we've talked about the Da Vinci Code, and in that first episode, I said that it's a novel I love. That's true. I absolutely love the Da Vinci Code. And I just think it's stellar on plot and it's stellar on world. But it's not great on character, which is what Joe said earlier. And I was thinking about, well, how do you take this Grail quest and make it good at character? It's got to be more than that Mickey Mouse watch. And it suddenly struck me that Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade is a Grail quest, which is what the Da Vinci Code is. But it's one that has a lot of heart. It's got some really cool character. And so I was pondering this more, like, how do I teach this? What do I teach? And I thought of, so in Stephen Covey's The 7 Habits, he has this 2x2 matrix about what is important and what is urgent. So we have two columns. These things are urgent and these things are not urgent. That means they're timely, like I got to do it right now. And then we have two rows, and the bottom row is these are not important. And what Covey teaches is that if something is urgent but it's not important, you got to ignore it. Like, don't mess with that stuff. And then, of course, if it's not urgent or important, you never do it. So we're basically deleting that bottom row from our 2x2. But up top, we have what is urgent and important. And to me, that defines the Da Vinci Code. Like, every conflict in the Da Vinci Code is like, oh my gosh, I'm about to get shot, or I'm gonna
Yeah,
fall off of the back of this
everything is
car.
urgent. Yeah.
Yeah, everything. Or they think I'm a murderer, and if I don't run right now, I'm not gonna be able to clear my name. It just does that over and over, like really, really urgent conflict. And in Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade, we have this conflict that's not at all urgent. In fact, it starts with Indiana Jones as a teenager in Scouts, and his dad ignores him. Because his dad is working on, he's studying the Grail, and he's like, get out of here, son. And he just like flat out neglects him. And obviously, that's emotionally scarring and hurtful. And then, 20 years later, or whenever the Last Crusade, the rest of it takes place, he's still struggling with that. So it wasn't an urgent conflict. It's something you can live your whole life with, but it was like this deep character conflict. And so now we go into the Last Crusade, and he gets to wrestle with his dad emotionally and say, Dad, why weren't you there? And they're still getting shot at. There's still the urgent, but there's also this not urgent conflict. And I think it's really deep. And it's kind of what makes me think, oh, The Last Crusade is a great character story. Sorry, Joe, you had something to throw in there, I think.
I was going to say, but not only that, but I mean, Indiana Jones has more than a Mickey Mouse watch. He's got a whole style that's unforgettable about him. The cowboy hat, the bomber jacket, the leather whip, the fear of snakes, like
Yeah, and so just
there.
the fact that you already named like five or six things just now off the cuff that define him as a person.
Yeah, and so with Indiana Jones, there's so many unique pieces to him that he really stands out. So.
Yeah, no, it's awesome. And he is a deep character. And again, Robert Langdon has the beginnings of these, but it's like it's a first draft and we need more. So, like his tweed jackets or his bow ties or whatever. But yeah, it just doesn't get there. So, again, I just watched National Treasure. And there's the urgent plot that, they're trying to find this lost treasure and they're getting shot at, whatever, car chases and stuff. But the main character, Ben Gates, is kind of a social outcast. And so he's got this non-urgent conflict about how can I prove myself to people that I'm not a weirdo? Because that's how I've been treated my whole life. And so then he meets this Abigail and they connect and there's kind of that romance. But it's about him proving himself that, look, I'm not as weird and creepy as everybody says I am. To me, that's a significant conflict. And again, a non-urgent character conflict. And that movie actually does the opposite with the father. So the father in that one says, stop doing the Grail quest. I mean, it's not the Grail, but and the son is like, no, I need to do this, Dad. And they have their reconciliation too. And I noticed on Rotten Tomatoes that the audience gave it a much higher score than the critics. And I think it's because the audience sees those character conflicts and they're like, wow, like that was heartwarming and meaningful, along with all the fun, cool, fast action. And I think that's kind of why the audience rates that movie so high. But Okay, so I promise villains. This is where we're wrapping up villains. We talked about in the last episode that a hero ought to be likable and good. So that's or relatable and good. That's pet the dog, save the cat. One way to make a villain is to do the opposite. So he's not relatable. And I hate to pick on bird watchers. I have a friend who's a bird watcher, but I don't have a lot of friends. I have a lot of friends who watch movies. I have a lot of friends who play video games. I have a lot of friends who watch sports, but I only have one friend who's a bird watcher. And so that makes it kind of harder to relate to, right? If you give that character that trait. And that's what you can do with a villain. You can make your villain like, oh, I don't get that. They seem so strange, so foreign, so weird to me. And again, that's the exact opposite of you want of what you want to do with your hero. And then the same with save the cat, right? The hero goes out and saves the cat. A villain goes out there and kicks the cat, right? It's the opposite. And you're like, I hate this person because they are bad. And that's like you can get your reader to feel that.
I know at one point we talked about this, but part of this is simply the order in which you present events, right? It's about leveraging that first impression, because once we have that impression of people, we start building evidence to support that. And so if our initial reaction is to like a character, then we start building evidence to support why we like that. So let's go to Indiana Jones. Right. When we first meet Indiana Jones, he's being very clever at navigating these traps. And that establishes, right, that we like him, right? We like Indiana Jones. And so when he is afraid of snakes, we don't see him as a coward. We see him as relatable. But you switch the order of those events, and he seems cowardly, not likable. For snakes, and it doesn't change what it is. It just changes that first impression and how that changes our reaction to the future traits. Similarly, with our villains, right? Complicating a villain is about having them do good things too, right? But if our initial reaction is we don't like this person, then rather than, them doing good things later, complicating them. So yeah, you see what I'm saying.
Yeah, and I think it's an excellent and a really important point. Let's see. Oh, yeah. So a second way that you can write a villain, and I think this is really important as we talked about dynamic and deep characters, is you make them likable and good, but they have an objective that is in conflict with the hero. And I mean, that essentially means there's some sort of zero-sum game going on where if the hero gets that, the villain loses something. And I actually have several villains in my Star Child series, and I have one that is just kind of this despicable and not dynamic villain that is easy to hate. And then I have another one that probably causes more havoc for the heroes, but you understand him and you actually get his objective and why he's doing these things. So I wanted to bring up there's a show I loved as a kid called Gargoyles, and
Oh yeah, I remember the Gargoyles.
they have the coolest villain named Xanatos, and he's kind of a Batman where he's wealthy and smart, and he uses his wealth to create this really cool tech that makes him powerful. But they actually develop his character in a really cool way so that not only do you admire that he's clever, which you do, but there's a woman that he falls in love with. And you could tell that if she were hurt, he would be terribly damaged. So he has a lot to lose, and it's something that anybody would hate to lose. And then later he has a child and he cares about and tries to protect the child. And sometimes that is what causes him to do these seemingly evil things that, that becomes antagonism for the gargoyles, who are the heroes. But he's doing them for a good reason, or for what the audience could perceive as a good reason. And I just think he's a stellar example of the villain. I also want to mention these three IPs that I've actually never watched or read any of them. I've listened to the Wicked soundtrack, but I know the premise. The premise of Wicked is that the Wicked Witch actually has a story that it makes sense that she did what she did, and she was painted in the wrong light. John Gardner wrote Grendel, and it's basically like saying, man, this mean Viking named Beowulf came out of nowhere, this evil Beowulf, and like roughed up Grendel, you know, killed his mom or whatever. And then Maleficent, I think, kind of shows her perspective. Again, I haven't seen it. I wish I could. But there's this genre of taking a villain that used to be flat and turning them into a dynamic character. And I think if you do that in your story, it can be super cool. And then just, this is my last slide of lecture. We've talked about Jamie Lannister a ton, but in at the beginning of book one, he hurts Bran Stark in an absolutely deplorable way. And like, he's that first type of villain that it's just like, you hate him because he's bad. But then in the sequels, it starts to show what was driving that choice and how he did that to protect a secret. And that secret is what held the one thing he loved. And anyway, you just get into his background and you love him as a villain and as a hero. And it's a super cool transformation.
He is very complex.
Yeah, yeah. Like maybe the perfect example of this whole thing. So,
yeah.
Okay, so the homework, click on the link in the description. That'll load the character sketch Bible. And you ought to do the top, the short list for at least five of your characters. I forgot that I put that. You should probably do that for all your main characters. And then maybe go into depth on one or two of your other heroes. Maybe do the long version. Oh, and something I didn't mention. When I write the 20-page version that turns into 40 pages as I answer it, I only use like 10% or less of the things that I write. There, I come up with a lot of really cool, interesting stuff, but thematically, only a couple gems really matter. But as you do this, don't get frustrated. Like, think of it as panning for gold, right? There's going to be a lot of dirt and sand, but there's gold in the middle of it. And writing out the long version is going to help you find those little gems that are hidden among the dross and whatnot. Mm. So, okay, that's all I got for today. Our next episode is going to dive into plot, finally. And I haven't prepared the lecture, but I'm excited about it. So we'll see you next time. Joe, any final comments?
No, we're good.
Okay, everyone, thank you so much for listening. It's time to start writing.